Hi, this is John Stone from 10,000 Blades, and you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM, streaming live at newhavenindependent.org. All the best of food and drink, a glass of wine, a smile, a wink. Don't have a cow, don't make a stink, it's Lucy in the kitchen sink.
Yay! Hey, New Haveners. Yay! Hey, New Haveners, and welcome back to another episode of Kitchen Sink. So today we're super casual. Valentine's Day is coming up. In theory, I wanted to have something really profound, like New Haven chefs coming on and talking about the food that they make around Valentine's Day and whether or not that's different, or a psychologist coming on and talking about the relationship between food and love and sex and what a cook to get you laid. Maybe we'll get into that. But I have something even better, which is just talking about why we make food for people that we love. So I have two different people in the studio. They're both hosts here at WNHH. They both write for the New Haven Independent. Brian Slattery is the arts editor for the New Haven Independent and host of Northern Remedy on WNHH. And a really amazing music writer, too. So, Brian, welcome.
Hey.
And hey. This episode is actually just going to be us doing variations on hey girl,
yeah.
Hey boo, hey bo.
Are there more variations than those four? It sounds like.
We'll find them.
We'll find them. Okay.
Find them and kill them.
Tom Breen is a writer for the New Haven Independent. He's covered, I would say, everything at this point, from sort of rock, punk rock for refugees, to really interesting finance stuff that I don't completely understand. Tom's also here today because he is my partner, and we do a lot of cooking together, and we do a lot of learning together in the kitchen. So welcome, Tom. Welcome to both of you.
It's a pleasure to be here. I wasn't sure if you were going to come out and write and say that we were in a relationship. So my first comment was going to be, Lucy, will you be my girlfriend? Alive on air.
Your girlfriend or your Valentine?
No.
Both.
Okay. But it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. So one thing that I want to just kick off the conversation with, and people have been writing in over Facebook, which I really love, saying, this is why I cook for people I care about. So this morning I put the question out there. If you are my Facebook friend and you're hearing this and thinking, well, I cook for people I love, then write under that question, why do you cook for people you care about? If you're not my Facebook friend, go find me, Lucy Gellman, G-E-L-L-M-A-N, on Facebook. And then you can comment too. Or send me an email if you want to send me an email, or send me a text message, whatever. Super chill. But Brian and Tom, I'm going to just throw the question out there. First of all, why do we cook for people we care about? And then we'll sort of get into the nitty gritty of it.
You should go first.
Do it. Thank you for that, Brian. Okay. So a disclaimer at the top, I am woefully inept at talking about anything food related, thus making me perhaps the least qualified guest for the show, but I've been on a few times.
Tom once described something as deliciously bland something and nutty.
Deliciously bland.
Yeah. So don't expect too much. But I think that I'm glad that you started there, because I do love to cook. I've certainly spent a lot more time in the kitchen since we've started going out, and we've been going out for over 3 years now. And I think that when you ask, why do we cook for people we love? The answer for me is, we cook to spend time with the people we love. I think that there's nothing quite like creating a meal, something as banal and something as special as the food that you're going to eat with someone you really care about. And yes, it's great surprising them with something special, and it's great, you know, putting in a lot of like time and effort and money into making something that is kind of a unique experience. But when I think about cooking as like relationship building, it's all about the time that you spend together in the kitchen, because it's you're focused on achieving, like, it's goal oriented stuff, but also you get to eat something really tasty at the end.
Hopefully.
that's, you know what, if it doesn't come out tasting okay, at least you spent time in the kitchen together.
Yeah, right. I was. Thanks for letting me figure out what I was going to say by talking.
My pleasure.
So, yeah,
that'll be our relationship for this show.
That's right. That's it. Yeah. Well, what occurred to me is that like nothing makes me feel more ethnic than that question, because my first thought is like, why wouldn't I cook for people that I love. You know, it's just like, it's just what I'm sort of supposed to do. So I do it. And it's one of those, you know, ways I was raised that I've never questioned. And I've certainly questioned a lot about, you know, certain aspects of the way I was raised, but food is not one of them. And, you know, the idea of making food for people is like so fundamental to what I think about when people are in my house that I kind of just do it all the time. Like the, when I was in preparation for this show, I asked my wife like what she particularly likes that I cook, that she feels like, you know, I put a lot of work into it. And she basically said like, everything you cook tastes like you care about the people that you're cooking for. And it's true. The more like, and the more people are there, the better the food gets, because I, because there are just that many more people and I want to make sure everybody's really happy. So it's a pretty like, thinking about this show has made me realize how kind of like fundamental it all is, which is kind of cool.
And Brian, you touched on a lot of things, so I want to unpack that. But one thing that maybe our listeners are wondering about, maybe they're not, because it is a little antiquated, but you're both guys. And I have had male friends in the past who don't cook, sort of all ages, who have never really learned how to cook.
That's crazy.
And yeah, I think it's absolutely crazy. But it's also, I mean, do you run into that stereotype of maybe you're not the best cook in the house? Brian, I know that I would probably be safe saying that you cook most of the meals at home.
Yes, I would say I cook 99% of them.
Yeah. And you enjoy doing it. And that's yes. been the case since like forever, right?
Well, okay. So when Steph and I first moved in together, when she was in med school, and it was especially her third year of med school, which I don't recommend to anybody, having seen someone going through it. But you know, in that case, like there was no way that Steph would ever cook anything that year, especially that year. And you know, me cooking for her was sort of like probably the most valuable nutrition she got for the course of the that entire year. And that sort of established a pattern in our relationship. You know, once, you know, medical training gets a little bit easier after that. But by then, like, the pattern was well established that I would cook all the time, which I like doing anyway. And at one point, we sort of tried to split the cooking duties, and it just led to, like, a bunch of meals that neither of us were particularly satisfied with. So finally, I was like, why don't I just take this all back over again? And she's like, that sounds great.
Yeah, and then Tom, so what I've learned so far from the discussion is also that if you are in medical school and you somehow have the option to jump from year two to year four, you should do
it. Do it. Yeah, skip number three.
But Tom, you're
it's
someone...
super important to being a decent doctor, though.
Yeah. Tom, I mean, you're someone where I've gotten to watch sort of the evolution of your cooking skills, but tell me a little bit about when you started cooking, because when we met, I would say the standard meal was pasta and vegetables, and the vegetables were all cooked at the same time.
So I've always prided myself, at least since being a fully functioning adult after college and being able to grocery shop for myself, put together a healthy and tasty meal for myself. But certainly I was not one to push the culinary bounds in terms of which order food should be cooked. And I think that I'm sure that plenty of people who have sat in on the show and participated would probably agree with me in that it's good to not necessarily look at recipes all the time when you're cooking. You want to experiment. I think that my mode of experimentation is finding something that works for me and then doing it over and over and over and over again. But hey, if that involves a lot of vegetables sauteed and thrown together with some pasta, who am I to judge?
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I
mean, I feel like during the summer, like pasta and vegetables sure. is about as good as a meal can get. You know, it's the vegetables are great at that point.
And something you can make in bulk and serve over the course of a couple of days. But I could see how once we, you know, started being in a relationship, seeing someone cooking the same thing over and over and over again, it could be a bit sociopathic. But I think that how I started cooking has always been, at least with, you know, me as someone actually creating things in the kitchen, it's always been a social experience. It was with not necessarily out of like the requirement of sustenance, but cooking with friends in college, becoming comfortable with like different equipment in the kitchen. That all came through spending time with friends, spending time with people I wanted to be around. And yes, cooking is kind of a requirement to live within a budget and healthily. But in terms of how I actually got into cooking for myself, it always started with usually my friend Amar, but often another friend who said, hey, let's, you know, there's something that I want to try out in the kitchen tonight. Let's see if we can make this together.
Yeah, well, so I want to read one of the comments that I've been getting. This comes from Sam Moth, who's a musician, Brian, that you've actually written about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's great.
Yeah. And Sam writes, I cook for the people I love because I like to nourish them. So, Tom, sort of getting at the heart of your comment, I like to cook veggies and eggs, vitamin rich, filling. I never skimp on the butter. And my personal philosophy is that more types of fat in a dish, the better. For a while, I was making banh mi's. Tofu fried in butter, sriracha mayo, non-traditional but delicious, and avocado, three types of fat. Fat is good for the brain, for brain function, and I love people's minds. I want to nourish that in their bodies as well. So, of course, that gets into the question. I always think of the Mark Bittman article that came out a couple years ago that said butter is better. And sort of a bunch of people went crazy on both sides. Some said, oh, this is really great. And some nutritionists sort of freaked out. But what? I want to get into the what. So what
did you see my eye roll? I did the little, yeah.
To the nutritionist freaking out.
Yeah,
I assume.
I was hoping that was audible, but in case it wasn't.
Yes. Yeah. What is the sound that an eye roll would make?
It'd be kind of gross, actually.
It'd be like, oh.
Now that I think about it, I'm glad it wasn't audible.
That's why we're on Facebook Live. They can see it all.
But one question, of course, is you know, there's a what in there. And so what are we cooking? And I'll include myself in this as well. But, you know, Brian, when you think about what you want to cook, when you're really nourishing your family, your extended family, friends, colleagues, what does your mind go to?
Oh, wow. Well, so when I asked what my family's favorite things are, I mean, this goes straight to the whole nourishing thing. They both my wife and son said bolognese, which is a sauce that's not that hard to make, but takes forever. It's one of these, like, it takes 6 hours to cook it, and you can't speed that up. There's no something happens at hour four of cooking that's pretty crucial, and then it still needs two more hours, and then it all sort of comes together. So the reason that they pointed it out as being like one of the things that jumps out in their mind is that I don't usually have 6 hours to make anything. So when I make it, like, it's special to them, you know. But that's like that whole sort of olive oil. Somebody else had that great thing about, like, there's an olive oil butter line somewhere in Europe.
Oh, I think I was telling you the olive line. Yeah.
Yeah. Where kind of like the tofu curtain, like a Mason in Southern
Mass. If you're
Mass.
Under the olive line, you use olive oil. And if you're over the olive line, you use butter. And it also has to.
My people are all below. Hello. Yeah. We're firmly in the olive oil line.
And is a bolognese, is that 6 hours of attentiveness?
It's not really. Like, there's a lot of chopping, and then there's some cooking at the very beginning. And then speaking of kind of like keeping the fat level down, there's no oil in it. And you've taken most of the fat out of the meat as much as you can. So that the attentiveness is about not making sure it doesn't burn in the course of the 6 hours. So, like, every once in a while, you have to go in there and, like, scrape the bottom of the pot, because otherwise it's going to stick and burn, and then all of your work is for nothing.
So it's not something you can just let sit, which...
No, not really. Yeah. But it's not like you're sitting, it's not like you're watching it for 6 hours. It's more like you go do something, and then every 20 minutes or so, you have to go over there and make sure everything's okay. But that's about it. That's the one that has been pointed out. But, so... one of my favorite things to make for my family is actually paella, because they really like it, and it's also really fun to make, and is like kind of, it's like super labor intensive and also like really cool. Like, you do all these things that I don't normally do, like cleaning a squid and, you know, making this like the crazy like delicious paste that you put in to paella to make it taste the way that you want it to. You have to use like a mortar and pestle to do it. It's totally awesome.
Can you throw a few more ingredients at us for what goes into paella besides the clean squid?
So it's a lot of seafood, but that's not that big a deal. right? There's a lot of like, there's mussels and clams and then the squid. And then you're supposed to have, and then pork and chicken. It's as many animals as you can squeeze into one dish, which is, I don't actually eat that many animals, but then when I do, I eat all of them, I guess. And then but then like there's this paste that I have to look at the recipe because I don't make it often enough to know, but it's like this like garlic, paprika, and then there's like three or four other things in there that you like mash together. And like, that's the thing that like puts it all over the edge.
And Tom, before we get into maybe what you cook or the different dishes that you cook, when you're thinking about nourishing those around you, I want to read this very apt comment that we got from Kalila Brown Dean. Kalila is a superstar political scientist who is often on WNPR. So I'm very humbled that she took the time to comment on my my wee little Facebook feed. But Kalila says, cooking is intentional and deliberate. It forces you to stop and focus on every detail in a way that the rush of everyday life rarely allows. I cook for the people I love because it nourishes their bodies with the same intensity that their love nourishes my soul, which I really love that sentiment. And so, Tom, as someone who is, I think, still very much experimenting in the kitchen, what do you cook when you are thinking about nourishing the people around you? You're someone who also has always found family really important, which is something that I think about. And so,
not one of those family hating people.
Yeah,
no, but you're very.
Dumb.
But I think you're.
I know what you're saying.
You're very close.
I do have a pretty big and close family.
So you. I mean, you see your extended family members, right. I think, a lot, and you have always lived sort of within like train distance or within a couple hours of your family, which when I met you was very weird for me because since I've been 18 years old, I've had to take a plane to get home to my family or drive for like 10 hours.
So my family eats a lot of, especially because of the somewhat culinarily conservative nature of my dad and sister, there's a lot of like steak and french fries and potatoes and kind of meat and potatoes, literally. That is what they find nourishing and what their palates find most acceptable. And my mom is a very, courageous and experimental cooker, and she has made just innumerable delicious meals for me over the course of my life. But I think when I think about what I turn to when cooking for family or loved ones, you know, it's actually going to be maybe some people will interpret it as selfish, maybe as selfless, but we read Jonathan Safran Foer's Eating Animals a few months ago for a book club, and it really changed the way that I approach food. I think a lot of people, when they first kind of experience some investigative kind of muckraking journalism that exposes the horrors of like industrialized agriculture and meat production, they think, uh-oh, I can't eat meat anymore. So now when I think about what is like my selfish goal when I go into the kitchen to make food for other people is a proselytizing one. It's all right, let's see if I can convince one more person to be a vegetarian or at least to eat less meat, to recognize not just the breadth of flavors and nourishment that you can get from vegetables and from a lack of meat in your diet, but also I really love, like, there's nothing that I love more than sitting down at a table with friends and trying to tell them as like forcefully and convincingly as I can why I'm a vegetarian and why I think it's like an important social decision in my life to be a vegetarian, to try to spread that type of eating as widely as possible. So I can definitely, like, just hearing myself, I can see how obnoxious that could be, but also considering how important you can't make,
I'm
sure
right
you
now.
Can, and I'm sure it's not the same.
I mean, that's a whole, there's another name for that dish, which is, I mean, it's delicious.
Yeah.
But it's not, called rice. Vegetarian paella is
fried rice.
Well, speaking of social decisions, I want to remind listeners that hopefully you are making the social decision to listen to us on WNHHLP 103.5 FM. This is Kitchen Sink. I'm your host, Lucy Gelman, and I'm here in the studio with Brian Slattery and Tom Breen, who both write for the New Haven Independent and are hosts on WNHHLP. So, Tom, right before the station break, you were saying you like to sit down and talk to people about why you've made the choice for vegetarianism. But of course, something within, you know, when we're cooking for other people is the choice of dish that we make. And so I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners some dishes that you jump to say, you know, it's not meat and potatoes, but actually vegetables can be pretty exciting.
Well, I think that I'm going to be referencing a lot of dishes that we make together. So I by no means take credit for the kind of creative origin of these. But I think that some of the meals that I love making the most with you, especially when we're making it for other people, are the, you know, incredibly colorful ones. The ones that have chickpeas and spinach and carrots and couscous and feta cheese and things that are just kind of bursting with bright colors at any time of year. That really demonstrate, just looking down at it, that this is a it is something that you want to be around, you want to continue to look at and eat. And then on the exact opposite end of that, we made this phenomenal soup last night that had, it was a miso soup with red cabbage and carrots and tofu. And the red cabbage just made it this like horrible, putrid, like sickly looking shade of purple. And we were like, yes, because the things that look the worst sometimes taste the best.
It tasted, yeah.
I mean, so I'm going to offer both extremes. And it was, I mean, that's if I were to think about a meal to make for people that I love, to really push the vegetarianism and also the just nourishing angle, I think soups are the way to go, especially this time of year. It's like a sandwich or a salad. You just cram whatever you want in there and you hope that the flavors work out, and when they do, it'll last you for days.
And I have to really quickly, I have to bring in a comment from Karen Ponzio here. So I know from social media, Karen, if you're listening, that she was making a huge pot of macaroni and cheese last night that looked really, really good. And she said, delicious food does to the inside of your body what a hug does to the outside. It completes the circle of love and satisfaction. But I think nowhere is that truer than sort of warm food in the wintertime. Yesterday we had 14 inches of snow. And so I think a number of people either went home and made soup or bought soup, or if they had the day off, spent like the day kind of making maybe a tried and true soup recipe. Brian, I can see you nodding, so jump in.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what you said, Tom, I mean, like, I know I came across as being like, I eat animals all the time, but I actually don't. There's I have this thing where I basically don't eat them up until I can't stand it anymore. And then I just, you know, I go on this like day long binge. But then like weeks will go by where that doesn't happen. But it is, I agree with you that it's like totally important to me that the food that I'm making people is healthy. Like that's like good for them. Like one of the things that I blurted out at one point when I had made somebody some breakfast of like eggs and vegetables, you know, that I was saying like this is just as satisfying as having pork involved in this thing, which is what, you know, you typically quote unquote do. And what I blurted out was like, it's important to me that the food is really healthy, but it doesn't have to taste that way. You know, but it is important that the food is healthy. And I feel like I wasn't doing my job if I served somebody something that I didn't think was all that good for them, you know, that for all kinds of reasons, right?
Right. I think that gets to a really important point about the topic of the show, is that food, and really the very premise of Kitchen Sink, as I understand it, is that food, on the one hand, is like a requirement for living. Like you always need to eat in order to stay alive. But why we talk about food and why we love food and why we share it with people we love is because there's so much more that you can do with it. I mean, talking to two people who write about arts often, it does verge into that area of like artistic creativity. And so to think about it just as a form of sustenance really gives it short shrift.
And you know, one thing that I'm thinking about is John Schlesinger wrote in and said, as a former line cook, he asks people a lot what they want to be eating, especially his kids, which I thought was really, really sweet. And so I'm wondering, do either of you talk to people? Tom, usually you have to talk to me at some point, and I'm actually not. I was going to say I'm sorry about that, but I'm not sorry about that. But do you ask folks, you know, what would you like to be eating?
Yes. In fact, like I've gotten to the point where I don't even like deciding what I'm making. I make somebody else decide. I go like, well, what do you want? And I'll make it.
And usually,
No, go ahead.
Usually who is the person? So Brian, I know that in your immediate household, you have Steph and Leo,
yes,
your 9-year-old son.
They decide what we're eating.
Okay.
And then I make it. But I will literally say, like, just go to the store and get me ingredients and I will make what you want.
And what kind of stuff are they telling you? So I know that Leo actually is an extremely adventurous eater. He's not picky guy.
No.
And so what are they usually saying to you?
Well, these days, well, aside from clamoring to make more bolognese because we've run out, there's like today I made a soup before coming to work that's now cooking away. And yesterday I made quesadillas. These are all things that I just make them decide. And then I make it because I think if left to my own devices, I would end up getting in a little bit of a rut over, you know, certain things that I like. So I like being just told what to make because it keeps me on my toes.
Now, if you are often responding to requests from family members, does that mean that they do not have the privilege of offering any kind of criticism if they don't like what you ultimately make?
Oh, no, they can definitely offer criticism. It's totally fine. I mean, I can also feel free to reject that criticism. Like, I had a friend who, this is something I'm planning on making Leo do also, but he grew up in an enormous family. There were like 12 people in the house. And so his parents were like, we can't do this all the time. So as the kids got older, they would have a night where they had to make the dinner for the rest of the family. So that way, you don't have to cook you're cooking every 2 weeks basically, right? But they all had to figure out how to cook too. And he said something that has stuck with me. I mean, he was like 16 at the time, as was I. But he said something that totally stuck with me so far, and I'm 42 now, which is he said, I said, how do you make sure that everybody likes the food? He's like, I don't care about that. He's like, if you don't like the food, like, forget it. Like, nobody else is going to like it. You have to make sure that you like it first. And then you hope that by making something that you like, that other people will like it. And that rule has taken me a long way. Yeah, that I'm the first person that should enjoy it.
Yeah, that's such a common sentiment that I hear from filmmakers and musicians I talk to as well.
Yeah,
and that,
for sure.
It always asks, like, okay, who are you? These are art forms that ultimately you're presenting for other people to, think about and listen to and watch. So how does that question of audience affect the actual creation of the art? And they say, they always say, you have to start with what interests you, right? It has to meet that threshold, because once you're working towards the expectations of someone else, it inevitably kind of loses a little bit of what you're able to bring.
Right. Like, it sounds selfish at first, but in some ways, in a lot of ways, it's actually the opposite, right? Is that, like, my friend is thinking about, if I had to jump through the tastes of like 11 people before I made dinner, I'm going to end up with something pretty bland that probably nobody will enjoy that much. So he's saying, like, I'm going to at least make sure that it's tasty.
Like, and I think it also builds up, right, like, a little bit of an immune system too, because you can withstand criticism if you know that you liked it. Like, if a little bit of criticism from someone you love completely deterred you from making anything again, you'd be like, what's the point?
Yeah.
At least I know what I love. Yeah.
Just like your ability to eventually pick up hot things with your bare hands.
But then I guess for both of you, so we've gotten people writing in. Ratasha Smith says, usually it's the last thing I want to do after a long day of work. And I would agree with her there. But it's really great seeing my family, seeing my friends enjoy something I made for them. But where is that place? And I think it's a razor thin line between making something that you enjoy, that you want people to enjoy. Maybe you've even asked people, and then accommodating folks who are still really, really picky. I hear from parents sometimes who say, I've always got that dish of, white rice or pasta with butter ready to go. But Tom, I'm especially looking at you because there are people in your family who are very unadventurous eaters, who I think, wouldn't even touch the very purple soup that we had last night that was delicious, but but looked like someone had, debased it in a horrible way.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think it really changes a lot when you are cooking for children, like your own children. Like, I think that it becomes, you have to become a lot more attentive, or at least I'm eager to hear what Brian has to say, a lot more attentive to what people in your kind of immediate nuclear family are willing to eat when you go into the kitchen. Because when I think about family visiting, really when I think about anyone visiting, they're also, by coming over and like agreeing to have dinner at our place, they're kind of putting a little bit of trust in you and saying, okay, I'm willing to try out what it is that you're up for making. I don't, you know, that doesn't mean that you have, you know, free rein to just go crazy and make something you know they don't like or are allergic to, but ultimately, I don't think that there's like two, you're as the cook for like guests, you're responsible to make something that that I think is healthy, nourishing, looks great, but also is a little bit of like yourself, you know, like you're sharing a little bit of yourself with people. And if they really don't want that, I guess it's good to have something bland on hand, but I don't know. I feel like probably different people like different bland things. And so you can't just keep, you know, some cereal around, because what if they like Frosted Flakes instead of mini wheats?
And do they have the license? I mean, do when you have folks come over to your house, especially if they've told you, for instance, you know, I have a dietary issue, I don't eat meat, I don't eat dairy. I guess, where do you feel like people have the license to say flat out no, and you to respond, okay, I'll make you something else, versus, well, that's your problem, you can go home hungry?
Oh, I mean, I think if anyone has any kind of dietary restrictions, it's also incumbent upon me or the cook to like cater to those. And
If
it's
not, I mean, for sure,
even if it's not an allergy, even if it's like I'm vegetarian or vegan, then I think it's a requirement for me or you, whoever's cooking, to make something, or at least primarily things that
I was saying, if you've already done that and someone and just comes over and is extremely picky.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that
I ignore them.
Yeah. Like, what if they just don't feel well?
I just ignore the minute sort of levels of like, you know, how much salt are you going to put in that? I'm just like, don't worry about it.
Right. And then you make a salt shaker available.
I'm going to put in enough salt that you like it. You know, that's the, well, usually it's the other way around, that they want it to be less salty, right, or something. And I'm like, yeah.
But am I right, you know, in thinking that things change, like the calculus changes a little bit when you're cooking for your own child? Because,
oh, for sure,
you're the one responsible for feeding that kid.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I have had to like work out accommodations, which are now fine, is that I really like spicy things. And that puts me in like a real minority of people, right? That most people don't like the level of heat that I do like. So the for me, the big accommodations have been like condiments. You know, it's like you make sure I'll make something that I know tastes good without heat, and then I'll find a way to add the heat after I've made it. Yeah, you know, it's usually just like, as a result, I now have this like ridiculous collection of hot sauces that I've, you know, that I've encountered in my travels, essentially. Like, this is crazy, but like there's a place that I order hot sauce from that's like just in the middle of Virginia, because I came across this stuff in a grocery store in Harrisonburg, Virginia, on the way to a music festival, and I was like, this is really good. And now I order it by the case from this. I've never met them. At some point I should visit the farm and just talk about how big a fan I am of their hot sauce.
I don't think you're alone in that. I remember talking to a cinematographer during the 48 Hour Film Fest New Haven, a guy named Dave Sikora, who every year drives down to northern Florida to pick up one container of hot sauce that he really loves.
I totally see.
And I think people make those pilgrimages.
Totally. There's another place in DC that I get hot sauce from that I really like. But that's been a big, that's been a lot of fun, as it turns out, you know. And it also means that the food that I eat has gotten, you know, spicier and spicier. Like, I like breakfast to be spicy, you know, and that's like that's where like I think the rubber really hits the road. Like, do you like your breakfast to be as hot as like most people like their dinner to be? And when the answer to that question is yes, then you have a problem that only you can solve, right?
I love that idea of accommodations through condiments. But Lucy, what do you think? Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, if you're just joining us, we're talking about hot sauce because we are turning up the heat in the studio. It's WNHHLP 103.5 FM.
You did it.
This is Kitchen Sink, and I'm your host, Lucy Gellman. I'm here with Brian Slattery and Tom Breen. They're both they are both hosts at WNHHLP and writers for the New Haven Independent, and they're kind enough to be with me here talking about the food we make for people that we love. And
can I throw in one more related comment to the conversation we were just having about where you draw the line?
No.
Just a very quick one.
Yes.
And I think one more place where you draw the line is how much time things take to prepare, because that is kind of a deal breaker too. If you're
huge,
if you only have like half an hour for people who are expecting like a meal that takes 3 hours to prepare, ultimately, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly makes me think people who are listening, who are sort of interested in time and cooking and those sort of ratios, I highly recommend Peg Bracken's The I Hate to Cook book, which is old. I think it's from like the 1950s or 60s. But she's sort of really disgruntled, and that comes through the book. But it's a lot of short, I think, very nutritious meals that nourish both the soul and the body. But we had someone write in and say, so this is Liz Gillorin, who, Brian, I think you've also written about.
Yes.
She is a musician in New Haven, among many other talents. And she said, you know, part of it is the process of making the food and the love that goes into the physical process of making the food. And then part of it is sharing with people. But of course, that raises a question, because I think for some people, cooking is a solitary process and one that's very important and methodical to them and almost meditative. Whereas for some people, cooking is something they do all together. And so the first question I want to throw out to both of you is, what does it look like? Brian, I know you have mentioned that Leo now cooks with you a little more often.
Yes.
Especially when you've prepared for something big, like the Feast of the Seven Fishes. So let's jump in there.
Well, typically, so my ideal cooking situation is that I'm a firm believer in hierarchies, believe it or not, you know, and I think that cooking is one of those things where somebody has to be calling the shots. Like, somebody has to have the thing of like, here's what we're making and here's how we're making it. And then it's everybody else's job to just like follow the orders of that person. And I don't care which one I am. Actually, like, I'm not that, I don't always need to be in charge. I like really, really don't always need to be in charge, but I often am, because, you know, I'm the cook in our house. But my ideal thing is like somewhere in the middle of that, where like it can feel very solitary in the sense of like, you know, I want to make a thing and I know how I want it to be made. But my ideal thing is that it's that plus there's like 10 people swarming around the kitchen, either helping or not helping, but there's this kind of like general like sense of activity, and the food comes out better when it's kind of like a little party in the kitchen, especially if we're all drinking, it must be said. That helps. I firmly believe that like I cook better when I'm drinking at the same time.
Tom, I can see you smiling at me. I think it's because I have to have control in the kitchen at all times.
But I totally agree that hierarchy is important in the kitchen, because you don't want two people operating in completely two different mindsets about what you're making for dinner. You get a terrible hodgepodge. I do think that you certainly prefer one role in the kitchen over the other, and I, as a deferential person, like, hey, I'm happy to cede. So I think that what our kitchen usually looks like is we go grocery shopping together, really decide what we want to cook together, and then it's like, all right, Lucy, what do I do? And then an hour later, it's like, hey, that was really tasty.
Yeah, it's usually really good. But I will say, for anyone listening, Tom Breen is a master onion chopper. He's very, very talented at chopping onions and garlic very finely. So do either of you ever have moments where you like being alone in the kitchen, where you feel like there's a moment for that? There's kind of me time that you need to have in the kitchen?
Probably just about every day, actually. Like, I make like the things that I make for myself end up being like, they're not that complicated, but they're made like exactly how I want them to be made, right? With like, the spice thing is where this really comes in, that like, if I'm making something for myself, I like putting hot sauce on things, but I like it even more when I can like incorporate the chili right into the.
And what kind of things are those, Brian?
It could be anything. It's like, none of it is fancy. You know, it's basically like, say I'm making breakfast and I'm making like eggs and something, which is like pretty typical for me, with like maybe like four or five other ingredients. That's when, you know, the fun is of putting dried chilies or something involved in that, or fresh ones if I have them, and knowing like, well, this is something I get to make for myself that like I know that other people wouldn't even be able to eat. Like, it's too hot for them, but it is just what I want. And it's really nice, you know, to the point where sometimes I don't answer the phone if I'm cooking in a, you know, the phone rings, I go, forget it, this can wait.
I totally agree with Brian. I think that it's very important to for me to have some time to myself in the kitchen, but I think that it's almost always kind of for ancillary reasons to what I'm actually making. It really has to do with what the like food is and is going to taste like, and more to do with whether I want some time just by myself to think and kind of have my mind wander a little bit, especially if I know what I'm cooking. It's like the, it's kind of muscle memory, what is going to end up on my plate. And so it's kind of like going to the gym and running on a treadmill. You don't really have to think about the actions that your body is doing. And so your mind can be focused on a podcast or a radio that you're listening to, or some music that you're listening to, or something that troubled you earlier in the day. It's like therapeutic time. And so much more therapeutic than just sitting on the couch and trying to work it through. Sometimes your body really needs to be moving in order, and also producing something in order for you to kind of mentally get to a place where you can work through something that's going on. But also not just in like traumatic time, just to listen to the radio. I find that I almost focus better on what's being said during like a talk show when my body is making dinner.
You do hear from people who say that they think cooking is stressful, right? That they describe it that way, even if they're really good at it. Like they'll say like, oh, they describe it as stressful. Like, and I'm totally the opposite, where I think of cooking as like super relaxing, you know, to the point where, you know, what I think about if I ever get to retire, what that really looks like is just like a long series of elaborate meals.
Oh, I love that.
You know, that would just be like, hey, I have 3 hours to make dinner. Like, I'm going to make something really good.
I wonder if the stress hits people before they're in the kitchen. I think the stressful thing about cooking is maybe deciding what to make and then having all of the ingredients necessary. Because
some of my relatives, they find cooking, they're really good at it, but they do find it stressful. Like, the argument will happen, like, in the last 20 minutes, you know, because that's the point where you have, like, a lot of things going on at once. Mm-hmm. And then they, like, they'll have an argument with somebody over like something silly just because they're kind of stressed out about it.
Well,
and that's that point in the meal is when I can feel my blood pressure lower, even lower than it already is, because I'm just like, it is all happening.
But I do. So I want to get to another question sort of as our time winds down. But we got this really apt comment from Mindy Englert. Mindy's an English teacher at Co-op. And it's funny and sweet. But she says, my parents love me in a lot of ways, but cooking was not one of them. So maybe they too were stressed out by cooking. I was born in the 60s, a time of raising children with lots of benign neglect. Hence, there were a lot of tuna sandwiches, TV dinners, bottles of Coke, bowls of cereal, and trips to the diner in my childhood. My two best friends were from big Italian families. Those moms showed me what food is love meant. I knew when I grew up, I wanted to cook from scratch like they did. My daughter is growing up in such a different time with such a different family. She loves fruit, vegetables, and her mom's healthy homemade food. So
there you go.
I think that totally sort of encompasses the idea of what we cook for people we love. Eva Gertz, who's been on the show, also writes in. She should be here now. It's Eva, really... we miss you. And she writes in, it's basically the only skill I have that I can use to do anything good for anyone else in these days. That is not true, by the way. Eva is an extremely talented person. Another person who's been on the show before, Elise Dumphy, also a teacher and a big cook, writes, if it's for a special occasion, cook them something that takes time that you wouldn't normally prepare. Make their favorite, whatever it is. Bake the chocolate cake with red wine instead of milk or water. Make a corned beef at night so you can surprise them with freshly made hash and eggs for breakfast. We cook for people we love because it shows that we care. And we cook extra special things to show that our loved ones are worth it. Food nurtures, love nurtures. And so, of course, one of the reasons, as hokey as it is, that I wanted to have this is because Valentine's Day is coming up. And Valentine's Day, I think, has become sort of this barrage of sometimes red roses, but more often like teddy bears and heart-shaped chocolate that doesn't taste really good and has a high percentage of sugar and things studded with rhinestones and maybe like something bedazzled. But I want to know from both of you what you will be doing for Valentine's Day in the kitchen.
I'm looking at you first, Brian.
Well, so one of the things that brings Steph and I together is our sort of like mutual distaste of Valentine's Day. So we don't tend to care that much about it. I'm not even sure we're going to be together on Valentine's Day. I mean, again, because it doesn't even really register in our schedule, much like our anniversary, oddly enough. But the...
Oh, I understand the first...
The anniversary thing is crazy. Neither of us can like remember our anniversary. Yeah. It's really weird.
Yeah.
But in any case, but the real answer to that question, though, is that when I think about like a meal that I want to make that you know would be like something that people would be making for Valentine's Day, it ends up being something like what you're describing, where there's definitely a piece of fish involved.
Mm.
And then I would find a way to make it that I've never made it before. You know, I'd be thinking about like how I'd want it to taste, and I'd just be thinking about what ingredients I would need to get there. And those, they'd be like, it basically would be like fish and vegetables, and now I'm getting hungry. But the but the idea is that like I, for special occasions, I like making something that I've never made before. And all I have is this idea of like a taste in my head and like how I'm going to get there. And those dishes end up being like some of my favorite ones that I make, even though I can't reproduce them later.
And do you beta test, Brian? I mean, is that something that you do?
No, I just go out and buy the ingredients and I go for it. And
which has only had a bad consequence once, right? And that was goat stew.
Yeah, that was a disaster. But the like fish, I feel like I know what I'm doing. And even like, you know, the taste that I have, if I'm thinking of the taste that I want, like I pretty much know how to get there, you know, and it'll just be it's a combination of ingredients that I'm already familiar with.
Tom.
Oh, no. I think that's such a wonderful answer. I don't know what I could say. Well, I do think that if we did do something special culinarily for Valentine's Day, as ashamed as I am to say on a show all about cooking, we may go to like Mia's or a restaurant that we really hold dear and have gone for special occasions in months and years past. And I don't know how important it is for me to celebrate, you know, however hokey Valentine's Day is, if we just want to think about any day where you're kind of doing something special with food, with your loved one. I don't know. Like I think of cooking as such a mundane thing in the best possible way. Like this is something that I want to spend like every day doing with the person that I love, but it doesn't mean that I necessarily feel compelled to do something special in the kitchen, kind of making food on a special day. I kind of turn to the pros like Mia's for that. But maybe I should ask you, what do you want to do on Valentine's Day in terms of making food?
Oh, that's so cute. This is turning into like a little date on the air. I don't
I
know, but
I can go.
Ryan can go. No,
it's not
but
too late.
But I should say, you know, I do think I agree with all of the people who have written in and with both of you.
What wonderful comments you've gotten. Thanks for sharing this.
Yeah, totally.
That it really is important to put in the extra effort. One recipe I go to mentally, even though it's the dead of winter, is like crepes or galettes, which sometimes make a little fire in the kitchen if you do them incorrectly or with too much vegetable oil instead of butter. But crepes or galettes with ratatouille inside. So ratatouille is not something people usually make in the winter. It's not a winter dish, but it's very, very hearty. And with a little dollop of like goat cheese on top, I don't think there's anything better or specifically more romantic. Brian, I can see you trying to jump in. Our time is winding down.
No, I was just, as soon as I started thinking about the fish thing, I realized what flavors I wanted to be involved. So I'm thinking about that now.
Wait, so give us a little preview. As we wind down.
So there's definitely like coconut and ginger and garlic and some sort of hot pepper. And then there's another ingredient that I'm going to have to mull over in my head, but it's something almost like Worcestershire-y.
Mm.
And the type of fish?
Some type of white fish with enough flavor to handle it. And that's when I go to the number one fish market and I say, give me a piece of really fresh white fish with a lot of flavor.
Nice. Well, with that, I think with our listeners thinking of coconut, ginger, and something Worcestershire E. That might be a good place to wind down. If you're just joining us, I'm sorry you've missed the show. This has been
Take this that, has been, listener.
This has been Kitchen Sink on WNHHLP 103.5 FM. You can catch us on SoundCloud if you search for WNHH Community Radio. We're also WNHH Community Radio on Facebook, or you can find us at WNHHLP on Twitter. That's one word. Or Kitchen Sink with Lucy Gelman on iTunes. I have to say, we got a comment from someone who asked, please not to be named, but she said, don't eat too big of a meal if you're planning on doing something afterwards. So with that, I will say, proceed with caution on your Valentine's Day, and everyone eat very happily this weekend.